Retina Rounds, podcast number 15. Is office-based surgery right for you? In today's podcast, Retina Rounds welcomes Dr. Omar Shakir, a pioneer in office-based surgery. Dr. Shakir is founder of Coastal Eye Surgeons in Greenwich, Connecticut, and a clinical instructor at Yale University. Dr. Shakir practices as both a cataract refractive and a vitreoretinal surgeon, which, while more common abroad, is unique in the United States. In the podcast, he talks about forging his own path to create a practice that meets his professional goals and how office-based surgery has been a paradigm shift for him and his patients. Let's check it out.
Well, welcome everyone to Retina Rounds. We're pleased today to welcome Dr. Omar Shakir. Dr. Omar Shakir is the founder of Coastal Eye Surgeons in Greenwich, Connecticut, and a clinical instructor at the Yale University School of Medicine. Dr. Shakir is probably best known as a pioneer in office-based surgery, which is a very hot topic right now. I'm sure many of you have questions about this, and we hope to answer them today. Omar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Pradeep. And kudos to you, by the way. Before we get started, I want to give you your due credit for creating a powerhouse treasure trove of surgical videos and teaching, not just for fellows in training or residents, but really for us, even middle, late stage career. It's so nice to have someone working so hard in the background to expand the access to information in you know, an easily digestible way.
Well, thanks so much. No, it's definitely a labor of love, and the feedback's been really positive, so it keeps me going. So thank you for that. Let's just start a little bit about talking about your path to ophthalmology and specifically retina.
Yeah, so, you know, interestingly, when I was going through a website redesign, I thought it would be nice to include on my website a letter to my patients telling my story. And I encourage all the providers out there, whether even if you're not in private practice, to share your story, because each one of us has a unique story. And it really resonates really well with patients. So I remember sitting down to write the letter and thinking to myself, what is it? What is it that got me in? Like, what is the actual story? And some of us may have an idea until you start reflecting on it. You may not have a full capture of it. So mine started back in high school as a competitive baseball player and went on to play in college as well, Division III. And I had a sudden tanking in my batting average. And one of my teammates' dads knew something was up. He had seen me play since childhood. And it was, you know, his good grace that offered a free exam. He was an optometrist. And I went in, and turns out that I actually have formed frost keratoconus in one of my eyes. And it was my dominant distance eye, which was starting to progress, I guess, you know, that around that age 16, 17. And one thing led to another, and eventually ended up seeing a cornea specialist that sparked my interest in all of this and the anatomy and function of vision in general, which then steamrolled into my college years. I ended up doing a year at Wilmer Eye for a research internship, and then went on through medical school. Had some change. I think all of us go through different phases of our life where we may question our path, and I have definitely questioned it many times. I had actually applied to law school, got into law school, enrolled, disenrolled, and went to medical school. Eventually in medical school, had a change of heart, wanted to go into neurosurgery. And then I spent time with an awesome retina guy in Texas who let me sit side scope with him as a med student. And the first time I saw a vitrectomy, I was floored. And that was when I knew that this is where I wanted to be. You know, I don't encourage anyone to go into a specialty just because they love the subspecialty. They should love the specialty first. But for me, it was that. It was that reverse. I just loved retina so much. And you wanted to become an ophthalmologist. So it was that early interest and then carrying that through with research and then, you know, questioning it along the way. And then that really gave me that fortification that I chose the right pathway.
Well, that's great. I mean, it's very true. I hear that so much from people, colleagues, and definitely when, you know, interviewing people for fellowship programs, they're all drawn to retina when they first see that fundus, you know, intraoperatively. It's just a magnificent sight, and definitely was a draw for me as well.
There's nothing like it. I remember sitting side. I still remember that conversation side scope. He was so charismatic and calm during this vitrectomy, and just having done thousands of them, still sitting next to me saying, you know, this is really cool stuff that we do. You know, it's like we're operating in outer space in fluid and lights are off and here's a light inside of an eye. And he's telling me all this and I'm intently listening, thinking to myself, you know, not everybody gets that kind of exposure. And I was very lucky.
Yeah, you know, and what you said about loving the specialty is also, I think, very true. And in fact, what I've seen is that the residents who really take in everything in the subs in the in this field of ophthalmology, they really embrace every part of all the surgical subspecialties, and they make the most of those experiences as a resident. And even if they're subspecializing in retina, they tend to be the best surgeons, because a lot of the things that we can learn from our colleagues and other subspecialties can translate into better surgical skills as a retina specialist. But you're interesting in that you actually practice both anterior segment surgery and posterior segment surgery, which is actually commonplace outside of America. But in the United States, typically retina surgeons only perform retina surgery. They don't perform cataract surgery. So tell us a little bit about, how you ended up making that decision, and I'd love to learn a little bit more about how that impacts, some of the business side of ophthalmology with referrals and things like that.
Yeah, I get this question a lot, especially from trainees, actually, because they want to do this and they've never really seen a successful model of doing it, at least in the US, like you mentioned. And so, I've had a lot of conversations with people who hopefully have shaped their careers to do something similar to what I've done. I sort of fell back in love with anterior segment surgery in posterior segment fellowship. I knew I loved retina, and that's what I was 100% gung-ho about, went into fellowship. And then once I got there, I realized, man, I miss anterior segment surgery. Why do I have to be stuck in a niche? Why can't I do what I love? And that ends up being my overarching piece of advice to every trainee or even an early career. If you're looking to make a switch, it really all comes down to your passions, right? If it's something you love, you're probably going to be very good at it because you're genuinely and sincerely going to explore that field or interest with 100% passion. And you're going to look up things, you're going to keep up to date. And for me, I found myself going back to anterior segment surgery talks and videos during posterior segment fellowship. So coming out, I was not going to give up my anterior segment skills. I wanted to reinvigorate them. I sort of did like a mini fellowship to get my skills back up on the cataract side. And when I approached it with full-heartedness, which is to say, I'm not just dabbling in cataract surgery. We do it all, and we do premium cataract surgery, LED adjustable lens, toric implants, the new PanOptix Pro. I'll do even non-corneal refractive surgery, so ICL placement. We do the full gamut, and I'll do complex anterior segment stuff. I think that's well within the artillery of a skilled retina surgeon, but I do it sometimes with an anterior segment only approach. So I love it. I love the gratification of it. I love the beauty and sometimes the simplicity. Sometimes it does get very complex, but when you're departing vitrectomy, it's a really nice change to go to anterior segment surgery. And on the business side, it's very interesting. I was told by so many of the colleagues that I respect who are older than me that this is not going to be successful. This wouldn't work out. You can sort of dream of it in a vacuum, but in practicality, you're going to eat your own referral sources. Colleagues are not going to respect that. It's not a traditional model of practice, blah, blah, blah. And the list went on. But I didn't listen, had to develop thick skin. I think that's, and we'll get to it later, but I think that's also what allowed me to be successful in the early stages of OBS, is developing that thick skin and really kind of doing an introspection on what do I want out of this, forget what the field has traditionally done. And I found that this is what I wanted to do, and I wasn't going to give it up. And to do that, I had to open up my own practice. And no one was going to hire me to do that. So straight out of fellowship, I opened up my own practice. And I introduced myself to the optometrist, to the primary care docs, to everybody. And word of mouth, and marketing and doing hopefully a good job by patients and being sincere about it 7 years later has led us to, I think we just saw our 14,000th patient last week. So I think it works out very well. If it's something you're thinking about, I'd love to talk to whoever it is listening to this podcast more and hopefully ignite that fire.
No, that's really that's definitely an innovative way of practicing, and I'm sure a lot of people will want to learn more from you about that. But you mentioned OBS, office-based surgery, and that's really the main thing that I was hoping we could dive into today. For our viewers who aren't familiar with office-based surgery, tell us a little bit about what that means.
The first thing to know is that this is a full-fledged operating room. The term office-based surgery shouldn't be equated to a lesser than. In all respects, it's at or superseding that of an ambulatory surgical center or a hospital-based environment. We all traditionally are trained in programs that have hospital-based operating rooms, so we're very familiar with that. A lot of us have done ambulatory surgery center environments where it may be multi-specialty or maybe single specialty. And both of those pathways go through their own credentialing, their own licensure, go through the Department of Health to get a facility up and running. OBS, the only major departure from all of that is it does not require a separate facility license. That's the major differentiating factors. You do not need to go to the Department of Health and file for a separate facility. Now that's the case in pretty much every state. There are some states, like for instance, New Jersey, where that distinction is not as clear as it is in other states. So, I'll put an asterisk on that. But by and large, it does not require a separate facility license. And like I said, that's the only really differentiating factor. Apart from that, we are still Joint Commission accredited voluntarily. We still follow all the rules, regulations, and we still build to spec the same way you would build an ambulatory surgery center, just tailored to ophthalmology and tailored to retina. You don't need to build to orthopedic surgery specs or GI or anything else. So that makes it a lot more streamlined, a lot easier. And the equipment all services you. So that's what differentiates OBS. It is typically attached to your office. That's one of the big perks, is it is within your office. That's why it's called office-based surgery. It doesn't have to be. It could be somewhere else. It could be somewhere where you might find space that's not attached to your office. But typically, that is what consists of an OBS. And it's not a foreign concept, right? This isn't something that I invented or that even cataract surgeons invented. This had existed for a long time. Plastic surgeons, oftentimes because of their cash pay procedures, they figured this out a long time ago, that they'd rather have their own operating environment. And again, it looks and feels just like you're in an ASC, where an anesthesiologist may come in. They have the full code, crash cart and everything available. Even pre-op, post-op rooms look like you're in an ASC. Oral surgeons do this, complex oral surgeons like OMFS. They have these, dentists have op sometimes pseudo operating rooms. So this idea has been around. It's just, it had never really been performed on this scale in retina until really I delved into this area.
So, how did you first learn about office-based surgery? And then, what was it? What were the factors that made you think, well, this is going to be a better fit for me than operating in an ASC or a hospital-based environment?
Yeah, so I was operating in a traditional environment, both hospital-based and ASC, a mix of both. And initially, my wish was to have my own operating environment, which I had assumed would only be building my own ASC. And so that's how I started down this path, is I wanted to build my own ASC. It's not that I was unhappy operating in a hospital or ASC, but I wanted things to be done my way. I have a certain approach, and that's the way I run my practice. It's very much a boutique setting. It breaks paradigms and traditional thought processes. And I wanted the same thing on the surgical side. I want it to work for me and my patients, and not for facility administration, who may not be surgeons, right? And so I was going in the pathway of wanting to explore building my own ASC. When I came across office-based surgery consultants, and I found IOR partners. And I should stop here and say I have a financial disclosure that I am an investor and I'm a strategic advisory board member for IOR Partners, but I'll put aside any bias as best I can. So I found IOR Partners, and they had a really nice operation in getting centers launched for anterior segment surgery, but nothing w really had been done on the posterior segment side, really nationally. Even outside of IOR Partners. And so when I jumped into it, I said, well, for sure I could perform all of my anterior segment surgeries, which the volume was increasing year over year. It made total sense to do. But I was still questioning internally wh whether or not I could do posterior segment cases in this OBS. And it's funny because when I tell this story and I actually present on it, sometimes I reflect back on my original email I sent, and I had conveyed a sense of strong confidence about being able to do posterior segment surgery way back in 2020. And I don't even know if I actually felt that way. It was just something I wanted to convince Iowa that this could be done. And now reflecting back on it, I was on the money that this was definitely feasible. That's what led that. It was sort of the perfect storm of everything. It was me looking for a new environment. It was me being an anterior segment surgeon. It was me running into some difficulties with certificate of need in Connecticut and finding space, financing. This would have been multi-million dollar venture. I would have had to bring in partners to build an ASC. All of those things, roadblocks, some of them, created the perfect storm of making posterior segment happen in an OBS to be where we are today. This was about 3.5 to 4 years ago.
So did you think about maybe creating an office-based surgery space yourself, or did you feel like it really had to be done with a partner like IOR Partners?
I had not even thought about doing, because it's such a large undertaking. Yes, I did open up my own office, so I had, some wherewithal and some confidence in doing this on my own. But man, an operating room, it's a whole different beast. I mean, there are things that tenured surgeons don't even know that go into running. I'm still learning. And I'm 4 years into this, and I'm still learning all the things that go into running a successful operation in a surgical environment. I cannot stress more strongly that it doesn't need to be IOR partners, but you should have a consultant if you choose to do office-based surgery, because there's so much that goes into it. There's so much log books and protocol development, standard operating procedures, how you run your autoclaves, down to a nitty-gritty science of how it's being done in hospitals and ASCs. We port that same methodology over to an OBS that functions the same way. This is stuff that could be way beyond the scope of someone who's just interested in opening up an office-based surgical center. I would definitely stress upon to get at least a consultant involved.
And you mentioned the cost is quite different. What, if you feel comfortable saying, like, how much does it typically cost to open an office-based surgery versus an ASC?
Yeah, the easiest way to explain that is, of course, your equipment costs are the same no matter where you are, right? So your vitrectomy machine, or if you're doing a phaco machine as well, or your microscope, your surgical trays, your stretcher, all those things are the same whether you're hospital, ASC, or office-based. So that you can kind of take out of the equation. For those, and just in case people are wondering, well, how could you afford all that? You could finance them. And a lot of the vendors out there, now I have strong partnerships with all of those vendors and pushing office-based surgery to the forefront of the business needs of all of these vendors. They've come up with creative solutions. So there's no reason for financing to be a problem. You don't have to shell out millions of dollars of cash to get equipment. You can finance it over case volume. You could finance it on a traditional capital lease. There are different ways to do this, but that should not be a barrier. And then thinking about the construction of the actual space, that's the difference. The construction of the actual space, when you're doing it for an OBS, is really the walls, the electricity, the plumbing, the impenetrable floor, the actual hard cost that goes into that contracting and construction. It could, depending on your space, could range from 100K to maybe, quarter million. Way different than if you're building an ASC. Anyone who might be familiar with an ASC, instantly they know what I'm talking about. Those who are not familiar with it, it's worth doing a little bit of reading about it to understand how different it is. I mean, I'll tell you, in Connecticut, it is such an undertaking to build an ASC. You must have men's and women's locker rooms. They must communicate in a sterile environment to get to the pre-op environment. You must have separate pre-op and post-op areas. You have to be of a certain square footage size. You have to have large handicap accessible bathrooms. You need to have a shower. You need to have a nurse's station. You must have nursing employed. You must have pre, post-op, and intra-op nursing on staff. It is a huge undertaking to build an ASC. And for that, by the way, no one would do that without a consultant, right? So it's the same type of mentality I would bring to OBS. You can whittle down all of that. I don't have locker rooms. I do have a pre-op bathroom, but it's a normal bathroom. We share our pre-op post-op space, and we renovated it. We still have a sterile processing, sterile storage, but they're customized to our needs. So because of all of that, you can shave down expense a lot. Even to build just a single specialty, let's say ophthalmology only ASC, I mean, you might be talking about 3,000 to 4,000 square feet in Connecticut. That's just not feasible for a lot of people. And an OBS, I mean, I'm probably under 1,000 square feet. You could do it with 600 to 800 square feet. So because of all those differences, that's why it's so much more affordable to build an OBS.
And so you mentioned staffing. So who's staffing your OBS space?
Yeah, and before I go into the details of that, I want everyone to know that what I do is not necessarily the only way to do it, right? So when I speak and I speak confidently and strongly about how I do things, it's about how Omar Shakir does it. It's not to say that Pradeep needs to do it that way, right? So I do not have nursing, and I do not have anesthesiology or any anesthetist provider. That being said, you can make it look as traditional as you want. You could absolutely have pre-op, post-op nursing, intra-op. You can have a CRNA or an MD anesthesia provider come in. They could even go under their own contract, or they can be under you. I have, in thinking about innovating this space and really porting this into hopefully an international model to increase access to care, which is a huge passion of mine, I've thought about cutting out the unnecessary waste in my mind. Again, this is not something that may fit every surgeon out there. Every surgeon in their own right, in their own practice, should decide what they're comfortable with. But for me, I don't see the need for the large majority of cases to have this huge infrastructure of staffing. So what we do is we have our internal office staff function wearing multiple hats, a lot of cross training, and giving people extra sort of pride in their work by saying, "I'm not just a technician. I also sterilize instrumentation. I also know how to operate the femtosecond laser." Our practice manager functions as the circulator, one of the best damn circulators I've ever seen, and he's not an RN. He is incredible, knows where everything is in the sterile supply room, can function as pre-op, post-op, can go to the laser, knows the microscope inside out, knows the phaco vitrectomy machines inside out, knows all the instrumentation and cleaning and all that. And then, so in a nutshell, what we have is we have a per diem scrub tech. That scrub tech I trained in ophthalmology. I have two other scrub techs. One is my wife, who operates a clinical research entity, but also learned to scrub because she enjoys it. And then another who's our surgical counselor who knows how to scrub tech. Our practice manager serves as a circulator. We have a backup for the circulator. We have a pre-op, post-op individual who is a technician, also functions on the research side. And then we have another technician from clinic that functions on the sterile processing side. So that makes up our team. And then I myself am the surgeon. So that makes up the team. And we love that because it incorporates really the whole office into this. And we cross-train so many individuals that almost every single person, individual in our clinic knows how to do something in the operative environment. So it's such a close tie. And when patients come in, whether it's pre-op or post-op care, they're so well informed that they start a lot of the educational process before they've even had a face-to-face time with me, the patient.
No, that's really interesting. And what you said about kind of sort of whittling down the surgical experience to the sort of the essential components is something that I want to dive into a little bit more. Before we do that though, let's talk a little bit about why even do OBS, right? Like you mentioned that this is very much a paradigm shift. This is how you wanted your surgical environment, your surgical experience for your patients to reflect you as a surgeon. So what is different? I mean, I understand the difference in cost and the accreditation process, but what about what's the patient experience? How is that different?
Yeah, this is much the same argument as going from one practice environment to another practice environment. Forget surgery, right? A lot of our colleagues out there may switch career paths from going private to academic, or academic to private, or group to solo, or solo to group. and you're looking, you're clearly you're looking for something different in your career, and only you can know that what you want. So in the surgical setting, it's the same argument, which is only you can know what it is that you want, what you want your experience to be as the surgeon, what you want your patient experience to be. And that's the biggest perk of OBS, right? Forget everything else that I talk ad nauseum about, which is international access to care, charity care, community care, technology, all this. We could go on for hours about the benefits of OBS, innovation. The crux of it all is, how do you want to practice? And can you do that in your setting, or are you restrained and restricted? Most of us would agree that in other settings, because of multiple layers of bureaucratic administration, oftentimes non-surgeons, there are protocols and procedures and all these things that are placed upon you that you question, or you've just lost even that part of you questioning why. That part of me never died. From when I was a kid to where I am now, I just keep asking why. And I even ask why about the things that I'm doing without any overhead or anyone watching me, any other administration. So you have to ask yourself, why? Why do I have to do things this way or a certain way? In an OBS, you can do it any which way. So for me, I've reinvented that experience. Just to give you a short trip through what that surgical experience might be like for a patient, from consultation into surgery. First of all, we've cut down that time from when a patient is identified with a pathology to when they can get their care, sometimes within 30 minutes to an hour. Right? If you show up with endophthalmitis and that needs a vitrectomy, we're not waiting. We're not calling the hospital and saying, when can you fit us in? Are you going to bump us to the nighttime? We're just going to do it. We're going to stop clinic. We're going to reschedule patients. That takes priority. And that patient's going right back to the OBS because my staff knows, and they know that that's important. There's buy-in from everybody, and they'll go and get the OR cleaned up and ready in minutes to make sure that patient's taken care of. So that changes things significantly, right? That changes our approach as surgeons in one of the highest impact ways. And that's just starting with the experience. So time from identification of pathology to treatment. Removing and stripping all the barriers. So I do not require pre-op history and physical. I'm administering a Valium, and oftentimes there are patients who even elect, if you give them the choice, some patients may elect not even to take oral sedation. That's how crazy that our system has become in its protocols and procedures and algorithms, that we don't even give patients choices. They just come in, they get IV sedation oftentimes, and they get asked, what do you want to do in a code event situation? Why are we even at that conversation? Because if you give the patient a choice, they may say, I don't even think I want. If you can control my pain, I can control my anxiety. I might not even want this IV sedation. So that's the conversation I have with the patient after identification of the pathology and going towards treatment is, we'll give you a Valium if you so choose to. If you don't want it, you don't have to be compelled to take it. And for that reason, I don't require a pre-op physical, pre-op H&P, so that removes that barrier. I do not require fasting overnight because, again, we're not doing IV sedation, so there's no risk of aspiration here. So I encourage them to follow their normal routine. Please take your morning coffee or whatever it is. That's going to lower your anxiety. When you can wake up with the same routine, already your anxiety level is lower. We don't require them to come and change into a gown or, get the in the pre-op area, the EKG, the heart monitor, the leads and all that stuff. Yes, of course, we're checking vital signs, we're checking pulse ox, we're doing all those things, but we're doing it in a relaxed setting. So now let's get to the pre-op setting. So in the pre-op setting, they're given one time, and that one time is just their arrival time. We're not saying, oh, your surgical time is at 2 p.m., arrive 3 hours before so that you can finish the check-in process and all this stuff. And no, just come. And when you come, our operation is so streamlined because in OBS, you control the turnover times and you control all of this so efficiently that you know that this patient's going to hit the stretcher in 45 minutes to an hour, just time to dilate, basically. And so when they arrive in their street clothes, comfortable wear. We administer the Valium. We put them in a leather recliner that's heated and massaging. We give them these neuroresponsive headsets. This is something unique. Again, I think about every aspect of my practice and how we do things. And one of the things I wanted to get away from was pharmacologic control of anxiety. There are other better ways. Now with mental awareness being at the mental health awareness being at the forefront of society, I started thinking about this too. And so we do something from Vital Neuro called a neuroresponsive headset, which has EEG leads on the headset and responds to your alpha waves of anxiety, and will introduce soundscapes customized to that patient to bring them to a more sedated level without the influence of benzos or anything independent of that. So that gets them relaxed. And then a sequence of dilation drops. We've kind of reinvented that protocol a little bit as well, which we can talk about separately. And then we give them the lidocaine jelly anesthesia before they come into the operating room. And then when they get to the operating room, it either is going towards a TENONS block or subconjunctival block, which subconjunctival block may be foreign to a lot of retina surgeons, but another thing that we've reinvented to just block the surface, prep, drape in the usual sterile fashion, go into the procedure, and then patient walks out. There is no wheeling of a stretcher into a post-op area. They literally get up from the chair, either with a patch and shield or none in the case of a topical block, and walk into a post-operative examination room, where then we take a look, we document the post-operative exam. That's one of the other perks of being in an OBS, is that you can do that, whereas in an ASC, you don't really have an examination room to be able to do that. And then discharge with discharge instructions, and they sit with one of my staff members to go through everything. So it's a very, very, very different experience than being in a hospital or ambulatory surgery center environment.
What are you looking for in that post-operative examination?
So it's usually the topical block patients where I want to check pressure immediately post-op, and just in the same way you do post-op zeros in post-op day zeros in cataract surgery. Essentially, I'm doing a post-op day zero on a topical block case. So just one last slit lamp examination before they exit that I can document and record. Still, I see them on post-op day one, of course, but just an added thing.
But that's happening almost immediately after the surgery takes place, right? Okay.
Right.
So, I think that there's a huge value proposition there, right? To be able to basically dictate the terms of when you can get into the operating room. It's one of the most stressful parts of being a vitreoretinal surgeon, is just finding time for, we deal with emergencies all the time. And being able to, I mean, we can make ourselves available, but we can't manufacture space in an operating room, and finding surgical time can be very stressful and can certainly result in delays. So I love the idea of just being able to go straight to the operating room and be able to address pathology, as you said, endophthalmitis or other pathology that really needs to be addressed right away. I think that, just to play devil's advocate, one of the big concerns, at least in my mind, is, well, what about, I mean, safety is obviously the biggest issue, right? We definitely want to do the best for our patients, but we definitely don't want to cause any harm.
Yeah.
And, so many surgeons may feel uncomfortable not having any documented examination or clearance from another medical provider regarding suitability for going to the operating room. Even if a patient seems fine, you know, non-anxious and can tolerate it, things can change. I mean, one of the things that can happen even in an ASC setting is patient becomes very anxious and starts moving around, and that can really complicate surgery. But then you don't have operating room staff and anesthesiologists or anesthetists to help kind of sedate the patient and sort of allow you to complete the case. What if something really unexpected happens, like, you know, the patient has an MI or something else, you know, who's going to manage that? You know, so talk us through all of those concerns, because I'm sure people in the audience, people who are listening to this, are thinking those, are having those same questions.
Those are valid concerns. And the simple truth about it is, we won't know until we know, right? Ultimately, you need tens of thousands of cases to find out if there's a minute difference in safety concern. All we can do is operate within our professional knowledge, and, you know, obviously utilizing whatever we can in the literature to support why we're choosing to do what we do. And this may not be for everybody, right? If these concerns are so significant in you and your practice, then you shouldn't do it. But there are surgeons who may hear what I have to say and say, that makes sense, because to me it makes sense, right? And so there's going to be a certain rate of endophthalmitis or of intraoperative complication that just you can't depart from, even in the most perfect of environments, right? And so I know that an endophthalmitis is inevitable and it's going to happen. But I also believe strongly that I'm in no greater risk doing this in an OBS because I can control and understand every touch point. I know exactly how my instruments are sterilized and cleaned. And I look at the spore tests, I look at the indicators, I see how my scrub tech sets up the back table, I see how the patient is prepped. I drape the patient. I manage the post-op period. I know every single touch point, which actually is saying more than an ASC where I used to operate in the hospital where I used to operate, where I didn't have those touch points. I couldn't go back and watch the sterile processing department and how they did their things. Sometimes I'd arrive and the case has already been drawn up. You know, the cassette's already been loaded and the back table's already been prepped and everything's kind of ready to go. And in some environments, even the patient may be draped, and then you walk in and start the surgery. So I know in my center, I control all of those things. And all I can do is control them to the best of my ability. It's not to say that there's not a risk. Of course, there's a risk. I'm willing to take on that risk because I think I'm being thoughtful about it. Over the course of anterior segment surgeries, now we're probably at 150,000 plus nationwide within the capture of IOR partners, where we have real-world data on every single case. We're seeing a trend towards less risk. And one question would be, how could that be? How can there be less risk with, and it may be in multiple factors here, but it could be surgeons that choose to do office-based surgery. Maybe they're more confident, perhaps more skilled. Maybe they are, there's a more of a buy-in. Maybe there's more understanding. Maybe they're, whatever it could be. So some makeup about the surgeons, that's a possibility. More touch points on the sterile protocols and what goes into running a successful operating environment, more surgeon buy-in into that process. That may be a factor. Instrumentation. Typically, we're using better technology than may be available in an ASC or a hospital because you have to go through capital budgeting committees. They may be upgrading equipment maybe every 5 or 10 years or longer. So we're just doing better surgery with better technology. Who knows? There's lots of reasons why we're seeing that trend on the anterior segment side. And I do firmly believe that as this shakes out over the next 5 or 10 years, as more and more surgeons are jumping into office-based retina environment, we're going to see where the data leads. But right now I can tell you we're at least on par with what that rate is of endophthalmitis and other intraoperative risk. Hard to change, right? Whether you suffer an intraoperative retinal tear or a choroidal hemorrhage, and it's certainly happened to me. I've had a suprachoroidal hemorrhage. It doesn't have to do with the environment, right? I don't believe that that is the case. You know, this can happen to anyone at anywhere, anytime. The other perioperative risk factors, like we're talking about, risk of MI, like you said, or stroke, or just a syncopal episode of vasovagal, something like that. Some of that is also independent of the setting. And some of it may be influenced in a positive way in OBS because it's a less anxious environment. You're placing less stress internally. There's less of a stress response internally because you're not activating it. You're not in a new surgical environment where all of a sudden you get scared because you see buzzing alarms and dinging bells, and you're being asked about your code, you know, preference by an anesthesiologist you've never met. You're talking about the risks of IV anesthesia. And we can go on and on about, we all know what that's like. And we've been the patient on the other end of that. I certainly was recently, 6 months ago, and scared as hell. Even though I'm a surgeon, I was the patient on the table, and I was scared as hell about all these things. And thinking to myself, man, my patients have it kind of nice. Like it's so nice coming into our practice where your anxiety level is just way, way down. Patients who come in with certain comorbidities, I actually feel strongly, and I get debated on this a lot. I actually feel strongly about OBS being a better approach for them. I'll give you just a quick story, a quick example of a patient that I serve on call at a local academic university hospital. As a retina provider, and there was a patient being triaged in the ED while I was taking care of a MAC on RD. And that patient had been visiting the ED multiple times for high pressure with silicone oil in the eye for previous RD repair and couldn't get to the OR because he would always have positive cocaine in his urine. And anesthesia was going to cancel the case inevitably every time, even if they get them into the pre-op area to say this is an emergent case, anesthesia was going to cancel it. Now, of course, the recommendation is this patient needs to be free of any drug usage to have a safe surgery. But what if we do this? First of all, if we never get to do it, then we just let him go blind because we can't control his pressure and we can't remove the silicone oil. Is that an option? Or do we try to offer a solution knowing that we have the surgical ability to do that while keeping the risk low on everything else? And can we do that under oral sedation or forego the oral sedation completely because we're not going to stress the heart out? And we're not going to introduce the risk of intraoperative, we're not going to introduce that risk with intraoperative MI because we're not going to introduce any pharmacologics. And so that's essentially what we decided to do is not introduce any pharmacologics, convince the patient that this is safe and we can get you comfortable with a block. And then the rest is smooth sailing. And once I can get trocars in and remove oil, I mean, it's relatively simple. And so that's what we did. We were able to take care of a patient successfully in an environment where they otherwise would not have been able to take care of that patient. And I have stories like this over and over about a patient who was not anticoagulated, because they had different priorities in life. They were going through cancer treatment, and patient couldn't get an RD repair and was just sitting on this with an external provider for a long time until they ended up in the ED. And finding out the story, essentially figuring out that this patient really thought they were going to die of this cancer. And that's why they had not started anticoagulation. And I said, actually, this is a perfect situation. I don't need you. I don't want you to be anticoagulated for my vitrectomy. Let's just go and do it in the OBS. We just won't use any pharmacologics. It'll safely be done. And that patient was able to get taken care of. And again, this story happens time and time again. And those who debate me on the other side have never been on my side to see it from my perspective of patients getting taken care of in ways in which the settings that they operate in could not take care of those patients. And so I advocate strongly that this is why I say increased access to care. It's one of the components of it is the expanded patient eligibility for an OBS environment.
Yeah, and that's really a very interesting take on it. I think really valuable perspective. And sort of the way I think about OBS is sort of this sort of next iteration in the way that we deliver surgical care. I mean, historically, ophthalmic surgery was inpatient surgery. Then we transitioned to hospital-based outpatient surgery, and then ASC-based surgery, and now office-based surgery is really gaining a lot of popularity. Certainly, a lot more with anterior segment surgeons than posterior segment surgeons. But roughly, how many posterior segment surgeons are you aware of who are performing office-based surgery currently?
Yeah, we're over a dozen now, just over a dozen that I know of, and there's in the wings about another dozen, and then there's a massive private equity group that's beta testing this. That if they do well with it, which they will, that'll roll out pretty significantly. I know of an international site that's doing this that I had very close conversations with before they launched. One other thing I just wanted to mention about that I didn't touch on that you asked a question about is what happens if something happens. Of course, something can happen. It's no different than the patient being in your laser room and having a seizure, let's say. And I quote that example because that exactly happened to me. In between my OBS cases, I do lasers and I was going to do one. And sure enough, I walk in and I hear a thud and the patient had a seizure, first episode. And you triage it the way we're all trained to triage as medical professionals. I put the patient down, put the patient on the side, call 911, right? That's all you can do is stabilize the situation, call 911. That being said, I am ACLS certified. Every single staff member is BLS certified. We have a crash cart. We have it fully stocked with everything we need. We test a defibrillator every morning of surgery to make sure it's functional. And we have bag mask ventilator. We have everything that we could need to do a proper triage of a medical situation, and we run through simulation codes basically every 6 months. That's the way to do this. You can't make the risk zero, and you can only do so much to mitigate it. You just have to be prepared for when it happens, and the critical juncture is calling 911. That's really it. Even if you're an ASC and you're with a CRNA, the MD can't make it in the room, what are you going to do? Still to stabilize the situation and get the patient into the proper hands. So that's the same story in an OBS.
What about for patients again who they seem like they'd be great with office-based surgery? They're calm and not going to be get too anxious during surgery, but then intraoperatively, maybe the case goes longer than expected, or they become suddenly more anxious than you anticipated. How do you deal with that when you're also trying to perform the surgery?
Yeah, and that is a key differentiating factor that as a surgeon, you have to be comfortable also with being the total care provider, right? You have to be also okay with sort of being quarterbacking the anesthesia component and the anxiety component. I say anesthesia component, but we should change our thinking on that. It's really just about anxiety control. We're not talking about the total anesthesia experiences that an MD anesthesiologist would give. So all credit to them for the way that they manage their patients. We're not on the same level as that, but we can control anxiety because medicines are very good at that. And it's also about the non-medical, non-pharmacologic stuff. So of course, patients can get anxious in the middle of surgery. We've seen that happen even under IV sedation. And the quick answer to it is an anesthesiologist just pushes more midazolam or fentanyl or whatever it is. We have a similar approach where we have oral midazolam that melts under the tongue and can work within minutes. I rarely reach for that, but we do have that ability for a patient that gets all of a sudden extremely anxious or they didn't realize they were claustrophobic or whatever it is. We have a way to deal with that. But most of the time, it's just reassurance, it's confidence, it's handholding, it's the music, it's the staff, it's everything around them. It's telling them, I got you, like you're okay. And that often honestly works. I know it sounds silly, but it often honestly works is to say, I promise you, there's no more pain from this point forward. I just need another 15 minutes or whatever it is. This rarely happens, by the way. I'd say 90, almost 99% of patients, it's a smooth experience. But of course, you have to be prepared. If you want to do OBS, what are you going to do in that small minority of cases where a patient may get anxious? And, you do everything you can to mitigate it. We use these weighted blankets to provide a sense of calm over the patient. We can blow air under the drape. You can lift the drape off of their nose and mouth so that we have like a drape holder to do that so that they don't feel suffocated. You can literally physically handhold. I have a staff member will hold the hand. Reassurance, music, make sure that's the music that they want so that they can just sort of be in tune with that instead of thinking about the surgery. Lots of things can be done. And I've never, knock on wood, I've done thousands of these cases. And I've not been in a situation now where I've had to abort a case because of that situation.
Are you monitoring patients? Do you have you said you have pulse ox on, blood pressure cuff. You don't have EKG leads on?
No. So I've also whittled that down. So initially, I was doing all of that intraoperatively as well. And it's oftentimes distracting to be looking at that and to be thinking and managing that while also operating. Now, we do all of it preoperatively. We record vitals, I'm looking at them, and I will decide to bring a patient in when I think they're calm and comfortable. Once they're in the operating room, I don't do any vital checking. So, assuming they've just had a benzo, for instance, I've seen the effect of that benzo for about 45 minutes because they've had Valium in their system from when they hit the door. We're looking at their vital signs. As long as they're laying flat and tolerant laying flat with their oxygenation, their breathing, then we're good to go. And I don't need to intraoperatively monitor vital signs. So I've not been doing intraoperative monitoring for a couple of years now. And that's one of the more beautiful things about doing office-based surgery with oral sedation is your or non-oral sedation is you're constantly in connection with your patient. They're not out. So you can assess the situation intraoperatively in real time throughout the case. And I'm when people come in and watch me operate, it's a different experience because first of all, the whole setting is different, but then they're hearing how I'm in tune with my patient the whole time, sometimes having a full-on conversation with the patient through my vitrectomy, or just constantly asking, how are you doing? Are you okay? And everything all right? And I do that throughout the case. So it's a little bit of a change in how you act as a surgeon, but it's been an amazing change.
Incredible. I want to go into a little bit more of the finances of the financial structure, billing, things like that are related to office-based surgery. And I was wondering if you might be willing to do a second session with us to just to kind of do a deeper dive into that, because for those people who are interested in adopting this as you have, I'm sure they're wondering, well, how can we make this financially viable? How does this work with insurance, et cetera? Would you be willing to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a whole separate discussion. There's a lot to talk about on that. Suffice it to say that you don't do this to get rich. this is not a money making venture, but it is a life changing venture. I mean, it will just patient experience, but also surgeon experience. It just makes everything so much better.
That'd be great. Well, thanks so much, Omar. This has been incredibly enlightening, and I think that you're doing something that's really a shift from the traditional norms in ophthalmic surgery, and we need people like you to push things forward. And as you said, I think time will tell whether this is how much of this off-space surgery will get adopted, and what the safety is, and so we'll look forward to seeing more as the adoption continues to increase. And I just want to thank you for sharing your insights, your process, and just for being, just very, very candid about your experience. I think that's really helpful for all of us.
Absolutely. No, thank you for giving me a platform to talk about it. This is something I'm very passionate about. And, not everybody wants to hear the debate, but everybody should hear the debate. There's so much input to have from our colleagues in the surgical field and non-surgical fields that to vet this and to make this what it's going to be in the future and something that's better for the whole field, everyone needs to be involved in feeding that conversation. So thank you for highlighting that.
Thanks, Omar.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website, and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.